Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Paul Anastas, Assistant Administrator for Research and Development at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Ken Beecher. Paul, science is the backbone for EPA's decision-making. All your efforts depend on the integrity of science you pursue. How are you promoting a culture of scientific integrity at EPA?
That's a great question, because this is something that President Obama has spoken to directly. The President's science advisor, John Holdren, has emphasized its importance, and Administrator Jackson has said that this is the foundation of all that we do. Scientific integrity is indeed the backbone of EPA work, and one of the things that we're proud of at EPA and in the Office of Research and Development is that we have a wonderful foundation and tradition of scientific integrity. One of the things that we have always done is ensure that, first and foremost, scientific misconduct, if it were ever to be taken place, is something that is taken extremely seriously and never never tolerated. I think it's fair to say that for areas of scientific misconduct, which is the most egregious element of scientific integrity, things like encountering falsification of data or plagiarism would be absolutely zero tolerance by anyone in the scientific community. And so that's certainly there. But more importantly, how do we get the assurance that our science is of the highest quality, the highest integrity? And we have both internal and external systems in place that ensure things like peer review, our board of scientific counselors, our scientific advisory board, the extensive peer reviews that we do ensure that scientific integrity is of the highest quality. But what we're also very excited about is that while we have a great foundation, the latest efforts by the by Administrator Jackson and Dr. Holdren and the President is building on that foundation and taking it to the next level to ensure that we are always going to have the systems in place to ensure that systematically we ensure that science as it's developed, the science as it's used is of the highest quality, that the public access of our scientists to speak freely on their scientific expertise and on their scientific reports is something that is valued and promoted and ensured. So the new scientific integrity plans are already in the public for review, going final, and it just is part of the tradition where we continue to raise the bar and ensuring that scientific integrity is first and foremost in our endeavors at EPA.
Well, Paul, I'd like to transition to nanotechnology, both the positives and possible negatives of nanotechnology. As I understand it, EPA leads the federal government in planning research directions for the environmental application and impact of nanotechnology and nanomaterial, that is, material made at the nano level. What is nanotechnology, and what are some of the key research areas being pursued in EPA's nanotechnology program?
So nanotechnology is an exciting area of innovation. It is the realization that if we take ultra-small particles, particles that are perhaps 1/10,000th the size of a human hair, that by designing these particles and engineering these particles, they give you new properties, new performance, new capabilities that cannot be attained by just the bulk material. Nano gold, nano silver, other constructed nanoparticles have tremendously exciting new properties and potential. So that is the science of nanotechnology that's being explored in laboratories around the United States and around the world. What the EPA does, as it always does, is looks to ensure that the innovations that can be derived from this new science is going to be done in a way that will not in any way hinder its development because of unanticipated hazards or risks. And so the programs at EPA are to better understand the ways that people could be exposed to nanosubstances, whether or not they're toxic under certain circumstances. And so it's that understanding of the potential impacts of nanotechnology that the Office of Research and Development focuses upon.
And I'd like to drill down a little bit as a follow-on. Would you elaborate on some new research to better understand how manufactured nanomaterials may harm human health and the environment?
So the question is whether or not these materials are capable of under normal circumstances where we might interact with them, whether they're capable of causing a problem or capable of causing a risk. So that would mean, for instance, can we inhale these substances? Can they get into our bodies? Are they bioavailable? What is the nature of them in our water or our air? So one is whether or not we can be exposed to these at levels that would be of concern, and two, if we are exposed to them, is there any risk, is there any hazard that we need to be knowledgeable about? So that's the kind of research questions that we're asking.
So shifting gears a little bit, I've read and I've heard on the media that natural gas plays a role in our nation's energy future. And in preparation of this show, I'm in no means an expert of hydraulic fracturing, but from what I understand, it is one way of assessing that resource. And in a fiscal year appropriations report, Congress directed EPA to study the relationship between hydraulic fracturing and drinking water. So first, what is hydraulic fracturing? And second, would you tell us more about the EPA study to understand the potential impacts of fracturing on drinking water resources?
Oh, certainly. So hydraulic fracturing is a technique where you can access natural gas by when you drill both vertically as well as horizontally under the surface, that fluids are put into the drilling hole at high pressures in order to fracture or break up the rock, releasing more natural gas to be collected. So this is a very effective way of accessing gas reserves that has been actually used for many decades, but only in recent years has tremendously increased in its application. So you're correct. Congress did direct the EPA to undertake a scientific assessment, a scientific study of asking the question, are there impacts on drinking water from this practice? So the study design was put together with extensive consultation with experts in the field, from universities, from industry, extensive engagement by the public into the study design. And we have launched into that study design after it was reviewed by our scientific advisory board, so making sure that it's extremely rigorous. And we'll let the science speak for itself. We've got these studies going on. It would be anti-scientific to presuppose the results of this study. And so we're approaching this to ask the right questions, ask the hard questions, and we'll be reporting on the answers as the data becomes available.
Right. So I mean, we've mentioned hydraulic fracturing. We mentioned nanotechnology. So And you mentioned earlier about the innovativeness and creativeness of your office. So can you elaborate more on EPA's pursuit of innovative drinking water technology to address the nation's aging water infrastructure?
Oh, certainly. One of the things that that the agency is well known for, especially out in our lab out in Cincinnati, is has a long history of pushing the boundaries on new approaches to drinking water and water purification. So we are engaged in not only looking at how we ensure that our aging water infrastructure is able to meet current demands, but also how do we think differently about our water infrastructure more generally? What I mean by that is there has been a history of using drinking water purification plants, treatment plants, wastewater treatment plants, in order to ensure the safety of the nation's drinking water supplies. What has been realized more recently is that a combination of not only the so-called gray infrastructure, water infrastructure, these drinking water plants, but also the green infrastructure of how you use natural systems, wetlands, and different green space in order to contribute to ensuring the purity of the water supply, and how those in combination, the green and the gray, are working in innovative ways. So there's a lot of very thoughtful work being done in partnership with forward-thinking cities and states in making this into a reality.
Right. So you've mentioned the thoughtful work and the importance of these programs. But given the finite resources that are at your disposal now, I mean, how does ORD know to increase scope of a particular program, if you will? How do you know when to decrease the funding or the resources of a program? Or how does, you know, how does ORD prioritize these very important programs?
One of the things the Office of Research and Development always does is recognize that, well, we may have a lot of brilliant scientists and engineers. We also know enough to listen to the people who are the end users of our research. Certainly our program offices, such as the Office of Water, Office of Air, Toxic Substances, and elsewhere, listening to the public. And so when we're designing these programs, we're designing them first and foremost to be as effective in dealing with the questions that the research questions that we identify. And that means getting the synergies, getting the efficiencies of achieving it, especially in a time of constrained resources. But we also want to make sure that we're asking the right questions. So it's one thing to be efficient. It's another thing to make sure that you're heading in the right direction. And so working with our Board of Scientific Counselors, working with the Science Advisory Board is something that we, and many others, is what we do routinely to ensure that we're heading in the right direction.
Paul, given the future-oriented nature of R&D programs, how do you measure return on investment? And more particularly, what are some of the unique challenges you face measuring performance and results within the R&D area?
So especially at a time during shrinking resources, the effectiveness and efficiency of research programs is going to be so important. And as you allude to it, the measurement of research is intrinsically difficult. And one of the things that we always return to is, more than any other metric that we have to put in place, is what positive impact came out of our research. And so it's easy to just measure the number of studies that were completed or the number of reports or papers that we put out. But the true measure that we always want to return to is how many of these projects were resulted in implementation and positive impact. And it's returning to those types of things. Did they inform a rule or a guidance document? That's one measure. If they did that result in cleaner air, cleaner water, cleaner land? Did this help inform industry or the public on different ways to approach different issues? And so developing those types of metrics, I think, are, while the most difficult, are also the most important.
Paul, I just have a quick question. It's a follow-up, really, about, with such an important mission, how do you empower your employees to actually achieve their stated goals in research and development? And how do you foster a culture of performance?
Well, it's interesting, because I have been known to repeatedly refer to the mission of the agency of protecting human health and the environment as our sacred mission. And I don't use that term lightly. It's when you think about the nature of that mission, it really is something that is beyond some narrowly defined goal, but it's fundamental to the survival of the people of our nation. So as well as the environment that that sustains life. So it is pretty darn important. And the one good thing is that I'd say everybody at EPA gets that. Everybody at, in the Office of Research and Development gets that. So the motivation comes from that mission. And so it's the clarity of showing how the work that they're doing relates directly to accomplishing that mission. The more that that connection is made crystalline and clear, the motivation stems directly from that.
What does the future hold for research within the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency? We will ask Dr. Paul Anastas, EPA's Assistant Administrator for Research and Development, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.